This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Palka. Five people were killed in an attack on a church west of Johannesburg, South Africa, Saturday. Police say some of the attackers took hostages who were later freed. Officers arrested around 40 people and seized 40 firearms, including rifles, shotguns, and handguns related to the attack on the International Pentecost Holiness Church in Zurbekum. Local media reported one potential motive for the attack is a power struggle at the church between rival factions. Hong Kong's pro-democracy politicians and activists urged people to vote this weekend in informal primary elections. They're choosing candidates who could run for legislative council seats in September. Members of Hong Kong's opposition camp set up hundreds of polling booths Saturday, despite warnings from authorities that could violate a new security law imposed by China. Beijing enacted the law on June 30th in response to Hong Kong's pro-democracy protest movement. It sparked widespread concern that freedoms granted to the semi-autonomous territory in 1997 will be crushed. The Get Out the Vote campaign is an informally organized effort to select democracy candidates who have the best chance of capturing legislative council seats. Democracy candidates would need to win more than 35 of the 70 council seats to regain the power to block government proposals. President Donald Trump has commuted the sentence of his longtime friend and advisor, Roger Stone. Stone was convicted of lying under oath and obstruction during the investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and had been sentenced to serve 3 years and 4 months. Follow this story on VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Jiangxi Province in southern China is seeing its highest flood warning Saturday. Torrential rain continues to batter much of the country, and state media reports there is a prediction Poyang Lake, attached to the Yangtze River, could overflow. The provincial government raised its flood control response from level 1 to 2 response level to 2-1 from 2, rather, according to the People's Daily. That is the top of China's four-tier scale. Zhengzhou County, an island in the middle of Asia's longest river at the end of the lake, issued a call on social media for everyone from the town from ages 18 to 60 to return and help fight the flood, citing a severe lack of hands to reinforce dams. As of 5 p.m. on Saturday, flooding had affected 5.2 million people. Serbian police said Saturday they arrested 71 people after violence erupted in Belgrade late Friday. It was the fourth night of anti-government protests triggered by another coronavirus lockdown. The head of Serbian police said 14 riot officers were injured. They tried to protect the parliament building with tear gas in downtown Belgrade from hundreds of right-wing protesters who tried to storm the building with rocks, bottles, and flares. The protests over President Aleksandar Vučić's handling of the pandemic evolved during the course of the week into anti-government demonstrations attended by thousands of people. Critics say the new surge in infections is the result of the government's decision to relax some lockdown measures in May and to allow parliamentary elections to be held on June 21st, which Vučić's Serbian Progressive Party largely won. Mali opposition groups urged their supporters to remain mobilized on Saturday after one of their leaders was detained in the wake of violent protests. Groups are protesting against the president and temporarily occupied state buildings. On Friday, police fired gunshots and tear gas to disperse protesters who had stormed parliament and the state broadcaster as part of a civil disobedience campaign aimed at forcing President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita to resign. Demonstrators say he failed to tackle Mali's security and economic problems. At least one person was killed in the protests on Friday. Reuters reports Singapore's ruling party has signaled a possible delay to its meticulous succession plans. This after the ruling party's worst ever election results. Via remote, I'm Liz Palka, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We have arraigned public officials accused of malfeasance. And in the People's Democratic Party, while we were in government, once any public official is indicted or has a case of corruption, he is released to the appropriate authorities for investigation and, when necessary, for prosecution.
The Nigerian main opposition People's Democratic Party demands the prosecution of former acting chairman of the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission over allegations of corruption.
Fisco has received in service, so it cannot be that certain parents are complaining about the lack of PPEs that have not been sent to our schools.
The Ghana Education Service warns political parties not to campaign on high school campuses ahead of the December general election.
It will be important that ministers demonstrate leadership skills to make sure that they maximize the contribution of the bureaucrats. For me, that would be key.
And Malawian President Dr. Lazarus Chakwera comes under criticism of allegations of naming family, friends, cronies and loan sharks in his cabinet. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Niaga Diop, a young Malian political leader, says youth groups are demanding the immediate and unconditional release of protesters arrested Friday. Diop, who is also one of the organizers of the Friday protest, says for now, the protests will continue until President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita meet their demands to resign. His remarks come after at least one person died in the capital, Bamako, Friday. This after the protesters attempted to occupy key government buildings and block main roads. Meanwhile, President Keita has sharply condemned the human and material losses due to the protest. For the latest development, I reached Niaga Diop in the Malian capital, Bamako.
Yesterday, some young leaders of M5, like Ansa and Adama Ben Yara Lucerbo and Isa Kaujim were arrested yesterday. Just I was with Ansa at the national TV, OSTM. So after protestation in this side, we got information about the arrestation of some young leaders. But about Isa Kaujim, for him, it is the rapid him in the house, not in the place of protestation.
Let me ask you this, Niaga. Why was Imam Diko not at the protest yesterday or Friday? Why was he not there?
You know, we organized two protestations, June 5 and June 19. So after that, the second one, Imam Diko told us to maintain pressure, but to calm down and to go home and to open the negotiation with Ibeka. So we passed 2 weeks in the negotiation, but the president didn't give us solution. So for yesterday, the absence of Imam Diko is normal, because if he was there, he can't tell to he have not arguments to for the people to calm down. It's for that Imam Diko was absent yesterday.
Niaga, let me ask you, so will the demonstrations continue to demand that President Keita resigns? Because I also understand that you have a plan for a press conference later in the day in Mali.
Yes, I can confirm you. We have a press conference today at 4 p.m. It is about to tell us of the strategies we are going to adopt for follow the protestation. This morning also, we have some meeting in the headquarters of M5. It is about for the arrestation of our young leaders. And for afternoon, it is just about how we can plan to follow our protestation against the president.
Niaga, as a youth leader and one of the organizers of the demonstrations, I understand a lot of the groups, including CIMAC, are demanding the immediate release and unconditional release
of all the youth leaders and those who were arrested on Friday. Talk to me about this.
We organized the meeting this morning, made a meeting to our headquarters just to know how we can find a solution to release our leaders without condition. If they're going to release or not our leaders. For this moment, I can tell you nothing about that.
Will the demonstrations continue? And will you still insist that the President Keita resigns? Because I understand you are also proposing a position of Prime Minister, that the President remains only a ceremonial President.
After the negotiation of ECOWAS and some national leaders, we accept to propose to the President a resolution, a memorandum. In this memorandum, we don't want the resignation of the President, but we have to design a Prime Minister in our side, and the resignation of National Assembly also, and etc. So, but the President in the address communication in the nation didn't accept our resolution.
Will the demonstrations continue, even though the President has agreed to your demands?
If he accepts our demand, of course we are going to stop our demonstration. But we are sure that this President, he can't accept our reivindication now, because we know him. He wants to put our country on fire. So for now, it's clear if the President can accept to resign or to show he want to a good resolution for this crisis, can see how we can follow or not our protestation. But now it's clear we want only one thing, is resignation. This is our main reivindication now.
Niaga Diop is a young Malian political leader and one of the organizers of the Friday protest. He spoke with me from the Malian capital, Bamako. Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, is calling for the prosecution of Ibrahim Magu, the acting chairman of the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, or EFCC. The group says the allegations against Magu is an embarrassment for Nigerians, since the group says he was tasked to lead the fight against graft only to engage in corrupt practices himself. The call came after President Muhammadu Buhari approved Magu's immediate suspension days after he was questioned by a presidential investigative panel. Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition party, the PDP. He tells me the allegations against Magu shows that the government lacks credibility in the fight against corruption.
Our party, the People's Democratic Party, holds the view, or we hold as a party, that given several cases of allegations of corruption against members of the ruling government that had been swept under the carpet in time, we hold that the investigation of Ibrahim Magu, the acting chairman of the Economic and Financial Crime Commission, must not be swept under the carpet as it has been done about allegations in the past, but must be prosecuted if cases of malfeasances are established against him.
Why is the PDP calling for this when the investigations have yet to be conclusively exhausted? And some people are saying these are just mere allegations. They are not substantive yet.
For the chairman of the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, upon whose shoulders rest the most talked about fight against corruption by President Muhammadu Buhari's administration, to have been taken in on allegations of corruption speaks volume. And as such, we know the tradition. We understand the system of President Muhammadu Buhari administration, that once there are allegations of malfeasance concerning members of his government or members of his party, such cases are never thoroughly investigated, neither are they prosecuted. On account of this, our party, the People's Democratic Party, holds that the case concerning the EFCC acting chairman, Ibrahim Magu, must not be swept under the carpet. It must be thoroughly investigated. And where cases of malfeasance have been established against Ibrahim Magu, the chairman of EFCC, it must be prosecuted.
Some people are suggesting that perhaps the corruption is fighting back, since he has fought corruption and he is regarded internationally as somebody who is above reproach, and he has conducted himself well in fighting corruption in Nigeria.
The allegations against Ibrahim Magu were raised and documented by the Attorney General of the Federation, who has a responsibility of supervision over his Economic and Financial Crimes Commission. And for us in the People's Democratic Party, we believe that allegations raised by the supervisory minister are very weighty, and they ought to be investigated, and where they are established, he must face prosecution. Our position in the People's Democratic Party is that the ball must be played in the interest of Nigerians, in the onerous duty of fighting corruption.
Kola, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that because of the allegations made against Ibrahim Magu, it becomes an embarrassment with regards to the fight against corruption in Nigeria? What do you say to that?
President Muhammadu Buhari's administration has always prided itself as a government that's fighting corruption. As a matter of fact, one of the cardinal campaign programs of President Muhammadu Buhari was to fight corruption. But the unfortunate thing is that the corruption that has been witnessed under President Muhammadu Buhari's administration is unwitnessed in the history of our country. And as such, it is not strange to the average Nigerian on the street there that the supposed champion of anti-corruption, the supposed fighter of corruption, has he himself been indicted over corruptible acts. So it is left for the administration of President Muhammadu Buhari to clean the audience table and to come clean before Nigerians that it is not the one encouraging corruption in public service. So for us in the People's Democratic Party, what has happened in the case of Ibrahim Magu has gone to buttress the general feeling among Nigerians that President Muhammadu Buhari and his administration are not fighting corruption. Rather, they are indulging corruptible acts.
For a major or the main opposition party in Nigeria, what is your stance regarding the fight against corruption in Nigeria currently?
It will interest you to know that the People's Democratic Party administration established the structure for the fight against corruption. The People's Democratic Party administration established the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission. It established the ICPC, the Independent Corrupt Practices Commission. So for us in the PDP, we have always stood against corruption. We have arraigned our governors. We have arraigned our ministers. We have arraigned our senate presidents. We have arraigned public officials accused of malfeasance. And in the People's Democratic Party, while we were in government, once any public official is indicted or has a case of corruption, he is released to the appropriate authorities for investigation and, when necessary, for prosecution. But in the last 5 years of the administration of President Muhammadu Buhari, nothing of such concerning fight against corruption has been witnessed.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition party, the PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The Ghana Education Service is cautioning political parties not to campaign on high school campuses ahead of the upcoming December general election. The service had requested the Electoral Commission to register students who are 18 years or older to vote in the polls. The Electoral Commission launched a two-day voter registration drive on campuses which are not close to designated voting centers. The process, which was aimed at registering students from high schools and vocational training institutions, ended Saturday. This as the Electoral Commission compiles a voter list to be used for the upcoming presidential, parliamentary and local representative polls on December 7. Echo Vincent is a public relations officer at the Ghana Education Service. He tells me that there will be sanctions against any political party that campaigns on campuses.
Peter, let me put on record that as part of the guidelines by the Ghana Education Service, political parties are not supposed to have any political campaigns or whatsoever in our various senior high schools. And for that matter, the Ghana Education Service Council has issued statement, clear statement, indicating that anybody who falls foul to this directive will be called to order.
So, Echo, if any political grouping flouts this regulation, which has been long-standing, as you enumerated in your first submission, what could be the repercussions? What are the punishments or what measures will the education service, the Ghana Education Service, you know, met out to any political party that flouts this regulation?
It depends on the extent to which the incident happened. And it also depends on the one who allowed the illegality to be perpetuated in our various senior high schools. And so because we have leadership in our various schools who are supposed to serve as local parentis, it is their sole responsibility as per law to ensure that some of these political campaigns are not allowed in our schools. And so if it becomes clear that it's the headmaster or the head teacher in the particular school that allowed this to happen, then of course the pack will have to stop.
Now, with regards to political campaigning and other political activities, does registration of prospective voters when it comes to those seniors in the high schools, does it come under that directive or is a separate measure altogether?
Absolutely not, because if you check the Chapter 7 of the 1982 Constitution, and if I may have to be more specific, Article 42, 43 thereabout, it gives the power to the Electoral Commission to conduct elections in this country. And so I believe that it is by the articles in the 1982 Constitution that is giving power of the that is giving the power to the Electoral Commission to ensure that students across the country will be able to register. Nobody can question necessarily as per law as to how the Electoral Commission does its work. Yesterday, there was a meeting by the Electoral Commission and the relevant stakeholders, especially the Ghana Education Service and the other political parties, where the Electoral Commission informed all political parties across the country that because of how the COVID-19 is affecting our regular schedules, it has become necessary for the Electoral Commission to conduct the registration processes in our various senior high school. And it will have to be noted that the necessary protocols that are supposed to be followed by students are followed in a way that will not bring about any casualties.
Echo, you understand some parents are expressing concern about the lack of PPEs for their students and that some schools have not gotten their PPEs as promised. Do you think their concerns are justified? And can the Ghana Education Service reassure these parents that their ward will be safe because they have all these PPEs to protect them against this coronavirus disease?
There is no justification whatsoever from the claim that government failed to submit PPEs to various schools. Now, as per the executive instrument that was triggered by the His Excellency the President of the Republic, that schools will have to be reopened. Days after, the Ghana Education Service set out the roadmap as to how schools are supposed to be reopened. Now, as part of the reopening processes, the Ghana Education Service announced that 3 nose masks are supposed to be provided to every student in this country. That is the final years who have been asked to go back to school and prepare for the examination. Now, the Ghana Education Service also indicated that Veronica buckets are supposed to be given to every school. Sanitizers were also supposed to be provided to every student. As I speak, Peter, I can tell you in authority that every school has received in service. So it cannot be that certain parents are complaining about the lack of PPEs that have not been sent to our schools.
Echo Vincent is a public relations officer at the Ghana Education Service. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. In Ivory Coast, senior officials of the governing party are reportedly urging President Alassane Ouattara to represent the group as its presidential candidate in the upcoming October poll. Local media reports say the leaders urged the president to seek additional terms in office following the sudden death of Prime Minister Amadou Gon Coulibaly. He was chosen as the presidential candidate for the ruling party after President Ouattara announced he will not seek a third term. His death has created uncertainty regarding who leads the party in the run-up to the presidential election. Julie Yabi, a political analyst based in the commercial capital Abidjan, tells me that the decision to seek re-election appears to be the preserve of President Ouattara, irrespective of the position of the ruling party officials.
President Ouattara was very clear in saying that he could run again because the constitution has been changed, and so if he declares his candidacy, it will be approved by the Constitutional Council. And he also threatened to some extent that he would be candidate if some other political actors from his generation were candidate. And now it is clear that former President Ari Konambejie is also the candidate of the PDC, which is one of the most important parties in the country. So it is possible that President Ouattara will accept the call by some of the members of his party to be the candidate. But I think it is too early to be sure of that.
So let me ask you, if he indeed decides to take call by officials of the ruling party to stand again, isn't he going back on his promise not to seek additional terms? And how will Ivorians accept this? Because he initially said he wasn't going to run again, although they expected him to do that, which was a shock. And people welcomed it both in Ivory Coast and internationally. What is your take?
Yeah, definitely think it would be quite a bad signal for President Ouattara to decide now to run again for a term, even if, the constitution might allow him to be candidate because there is a new constitution and a lot of presidents use that instrument, changing constitution, to be able to do more than two terms in the country. I think it would be a bad signal for President Ouattara to go into that direction. He might decide to run himself, or he will have to find someone that he can trust fully. And I think the choice of Gon Coulibaly was based on the very personal relationship that he had with the late Gon Coulibaly. And so if he feels that no one actually within the party can give him the full guarantees that he will not face problems after he leaves office, I think he will decide to run again.
Some people are suggesting that why should he even take this for the officials of the party to go to President Ouattara to ask him to run again? Couldn't they find anybody in the party who is strong enough and who is capable of winning the upcoming presidential election, if you may? So does that mean that without Ouattara, the ruling party cannot function? They asked. What do you say to that?
We have to look at the political culture in the country, and actually it's not only specific to Cote d'Ivoire. I think it is one of the major problems that we have in many countries on the continent, the feeling that everything has to be personalized and that just one person can be the ultimate savior of one party or of the savior of the country. They are over important figures within the ruling party who can be candidate, but that would be based on some understanding that politics should not be about one person, but about a team and about a kind of relationship between those who govern and those who are governed. And I think that what is happening in Cote d'Ivoire today is showing that the political culture in the country has not really evolved. And I think that's not only in the ruling party that we should be looking at that problem. If you you know, for example, that former President Ari Konambejie is 86 years old, while most of the population of the country is very young, then you can see that the problem again of a particular political culture is not just Ouattara's and the ruling party's problem. It is something which is more entrenched in the way politics and even the society functions.
At the moment, you have interacted with a lot of Ivorians. You live in Ivory Coast. You see the political atmosphere. What do you think are the current expectations of Ivorians ahead of the elections? Because some people say the country appears to be in a state of uncertainty with regards to whether President Ouattara will decide to seek re-election or additional terms in office, or what is even going to happen at all about the election?
Yes, there were a lot of uncertainties. There were already uncertainties about the electoral calendar because of the COVID-19 crisis, which has an impact on electoral preparations in Cote d'Ivoire, but also in other countries supposed to have election this year. And then you have the usual disagreements between the political parties regarding the condition of elections, the registration of the voters, and the independence of the Electoral Commission. So there were already some uncertainties. And this, the death of the official candidate of the ruling party, is definitely a new factor. But I think that the party and Ouattara will decide very soon, probably after the burial of Gon Coulibaly, they will decide on the candidacy of the RHDP. So, but I think, again, the question is not just who is going to be the candidate of the ruling party. The question is also what will be the credibility of the election itself. And there are many reasons to be worried about the electoral context in the country in the next few months.
Gilles Yabi is a political analyst based in Ivory Coast. He spoke
spoke with me from the commercial capital, Abidjan. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Malawian President Dr. Lazarus Chakwera has come under criticism after naming his cabinet. Critics say the team to help him administer the affairs of the Southern African country is fraught with family, friends, cronies and loan sharks. They also say Malawians voted for the Tonse Alliance, the current ruling party coalition, knowing that the new administration will be sharply different from the previous government. It's a major reason, they say, why President Arthur Peter Mutharika was rejected in the June 23 poll rerun. But in a nationwide address Friday, President Chakwera defended his cabinet, saying his appointments are based purely on merit and proven track records. Ernest Lamek is the General Secretary of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He tells me Malawians are anxious to see who in the new government will improve their living conditions.
Not necessarily that he said the team he has assembled will do a good job. But I think the key message coming from him is that give us some space within which we should demonstrate our competency to deliver the agenda. So what he has requested the citizenry is we give the cabinet and the president 5 months within which we should make an assessment. So for me, that is significant. We need to understand that whatever cabinet will have come out, there will always be concerns raised because different people have different interests, so it's not surprising that the president has faced criticism. I think much of it comes from the mere fact that there are some members who are a family, for instance, wife and husband. Some are sisters, some are in-laws. This is perhaps maybe a key central issue, but perhaps maybe other than looking at family ties, it may be important to look at whether the people can deliver or not.
So let me ask you this. One of the allegations leveled against the previous administration under President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika was that it was tribal, it was ethnocentric, it was concentrated on a particular region of the country. And that is what a lot of Malawians didn't like, among other allegations. And so they expected, when they voted overwhelmingly in a landslide to Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, they expected things to be different, only to be seeing that a lot of these ministers also come from a particular region of the country, which they said is a continuation of the old order, in spite of the speech of the president defending his pick. What do you say to that?
That is the general perception created. But perhaps maybe one other thing that people don't understand is that indeed most Malawian political parties are regional parties, meaning to say most of the capable people are likely to come from the central region where the party has its own stronghold. So naturally, when picking up the cabinet, one would be inclined to pick from where the reservoir is big from which to recruit. So it's not surprising the cabinet is dominated by people from the central region. Understandably so, as I said. That for me does not necessarily suggest it is an indication of regionalism or being tribal. I think Chakwera has done much, much better in terms of tribal and regional representation. You have, for instance, 8 from Northern Region, 8 from Southern Region, and 13 cabinet ministers from Central Region, which for me is fairly well distributed, unlike the previous administration, where 90% would come from the same tribe. And that was a concern for Malawians.
So moving forward, what yardstick do you think the president should look for in terms of determining whether a particular cabinet minister or his cabinet ministers are functioning and are producing results?
I think what would be critical is to come up with benchmark or performance indicator. Fortunately, in his response to concerns this afternoon, he had suggested that each minister will have benchmarks, meaning performance indicators against which their performance would be assessed. One would hope that these benchmarks would be generally accepted to most Malawians. So yes, what we need is performance indicators that will be communicated to the public, and the ministers would be assessed on the benchmark basis of those performance indicators, which are going to be measurable.
Did the president specifically outline which performance indicators he intends to implement for Malawians to assess, even though it is prerogative to assemble people, to give them benchmarks to meet, so there is transparency with regards to benchmarks or datum that he has set out for them to meet in order to ensure whether they qualify to continue as his officials or not?
He has suggested that he will give each and every minister 5 months within which they should demonstrate they are capable to deliver on the basis of the indicators to be developed. The indicators have not yet been developed. I am of the view that they'll be developed and they'll be shared certainly before they are agreed upon as a performance contract. They will have been shared and accepted by Malawians.
Looking at the high expectations of Malawians for which they voted overwhelmingly for this administration, do you think that the assembled team by the president is capable of meeting the expectation, looking at the benchmarks within 5 months that the president has laid out?
Certainly, the expectations are high. Malawians really need to see meaningful change. Whether the current ministers that have been assembled are capable or not remains to be seen. But for me, what will be important is not necessarily the personal competence of the ministers, but how good they will be in terms of engaging and utilizing the technocrats within the public service. So for the ministers, what will be key would be about leadership. In terms of management and achievement of specific goals for the ministry, it will be important that ministers demonstrate leadership skills to make sure that they maximize the contribution of the bureaucrats. For me, that would be key.
Ernest Lamech is the General Secretary of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Still in Malawi, a spike in COVID-19 cases has forced authorities to delay plans to reopen schools on July 13. The country is also running short of testing kits. The Southern African country recorded its highest number of confirmed cases in a single day last week, as the numbers near 2,000 with 29 deaths. For VOA, Lamech Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
The co-chair for the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19, John Puka, told VOA Friday that a critical shortage of test kits has forced the government to stop mass testing.
So what we've done is we have changed our testing to make sure that we only test those that have symptoms.
Puka attributes the shortage to logistical problems in shipping. He spoke via a messaging app.
The logistics around these tests is that we order them from abroad. So some of those kits come from Europe. And as we speak, because of logistic challenges on flights, we have some of the test kits stuck elsewhere in Europe.
He says the kits are expected to arrive in 2 weeks. Those who have had contacts with confirmed COVID-19 patients are being advised to isolate themselves for 10 to 14 days. Health rights campaigner George Jobe says he worries that the lack of testing could make the virus spread further and undetected. He spoke via a messaging app.
The negative effect is that we will stop knowing how many people have coronavirus, because the past times we have been reporting cases of those who have tested positive.
Malawi is currently facing a surge in cases, partially because of the winter season, which health experts say provides fertile ground for the coronavirus, which causes the COVID-19 disease. The surge is also attributed to a failure to control crowds during recent election campaign rallies and a return of migrant workers from South Africa. As of Friday, Malawi confirmed close to 1,990 cases, including almost 30 deaths. Officials say more than 700 of these cases have come from abroad, while 1,000 others have originated locally. The country, with a population of 18 million people, has so far tested about 19,000 people in its 39 testing centers. The spike in COVID-19 cases has forced the government to shelve plans to reopen schools next Monday. The schools closed in March as the coronavirus began to spread across southern Africa. Benedicto Kondowe is executive director for the Civil Society Education Coalition. He told VOA via telephone that the government should have allowed classes to reopen for students to take final examinations, but under strict COVID-19 guidelines.
Because currently we're aware that the online program, lessons through the radio as well as television, are leaving out millions of Malawians, especially those who are coming from poor backgrounds.
The Minister of Health says the government cannot risk the lives of students. The ministry says for the time being, the right to education must be suspended as government authorities monitor the situation. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Hilary Mosbeck, director of illicit policy at the Sentry, says the organization is making government and institutions aware that real estate in some African countries is being used to launder funds. The Sentry is described as an investigative and policy group which follows dirty money connected to African war criminals and transnational war profiteers. It seeks to identify those benefiting from violence out of the international financial system. In its recently released report, the Sentry says corrupt leaders and government officials are purchasing real estate in major African countries, including South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Namibia. The purchases, the report says, become a money laundering mechanism for these leaders and public officials. Ms. Mosbeck tells me that Sentry has shared its concerns and recommendations contained in the report to government and institutions, which she says could help to plug the loopholes in the real estate industry that feed corruption.
This emerging trend is worrisome. Many of these countries, you know, do not have the capacity to track and seize properties bought with corruption proceeds, and there is very little stopping corrupt actors from abusing these real estate sectors in major cities across Africa. So this week, the Sentry published an advisory detailing how these corrupt actors and their networks and family members have increasingly been using these African real estate markets to launder the proceeds of their corruption. And our advisory highlights how in cities like Nairobi and Kampala, Windhoek, Cape Town, Johannesburg, and elsewhere, banks and governments have not prioritized the money laundering risk in the real estate sectors, creating, you know, a growing opportunity for corrupt actors to exploit the sectors.
So Hilary, yeah. Do you think the report that Sentry produced recently would create the awareness to these governments to pay attention to what is happening in their own backyards?
Yes, the advisory provides recommendations to banks, governments, and those working in the real estate sector on how to address corruption risks and stem the flow of illicit finance. Properties in these cities are just as luxurious as properties in any major city around the world outside of Africa, but with much less oversight and scrutiny. Largely hidden from anti-corruption watchdogs, it makes them very attractive to corrupt actors. So the intent of the advisory is to, you know, raise awareness and give specific recommendations on what can be done.
So Hilary, what are the key indicators that could inform the authorities that perhaps these guys coming in or these individuals coming in with flush with cash, this is what they are doing in terms of money laundering and other criminal activities?
That's a great question. So the advisory describes several methods used by these political elites to purchase real estate in these countries and details the related red flags, like purchasing of real estate by family members and their associates in their names, but in, you know, family members' names. Also, the use of shell companies and trusts to purchase property, and the purchase of properties in foreign countries by individuals subject to international sanctions, and the use of unexplained wealth to purchase the properties.
After this report came out, have you shared these advisory to some of these governments, and what has been the responses that you've gotten so far about strengthening their institutions to combat this?
We have shared the advisory with governments and banks, and we've published it, you know, publicly on our website. We believe very strongly that actions by banks, governments, and other relevant actors in the real estate sectors to curb money laundering through real estate in the region can put pressure on these kleptocrats and also their facilitators and combat profiteering from corruption and violence elsewhere on the continent. We think there's a real opportunity here to share our information with the relevant authorities and encourage them to take more action. We've also called on the United States government to provide technical assistance to governments in the region to better equip themselves with the tools they need to root out corruption in the real estate sector.
Moving forward, what do you think Sentry can do in terms of adding additional pressure on these institutions, including the government, in order to curb this activity?
We have the Sentry is very focused on fighting illicit finance and corruption linked to war criminals and war profiteers. And we are looking for every opportunity to share our information and to pressure governments and the private sector to do more, and not just in Africa, but, you know, the banks that are in Europe, for example, or the United States that are facilitating these purchases need to do more and need to really understand what the risks are. And so with this advisory is our first product line of this sort. And moving forward, the Sentry will be publishing advisories that focus on specific sectors associated with grand corruption in sub-Saharan Africa. And the advisories will seek to raise awareness and provide insight on sector-specific risks to banks and relevant authorities, similar to publications issued by other governments like FinCEN, you know, with the United States and the UK. They'll contain useful information and guidance to mitigate specific risks.
Hilary Mosbeck is the director of illicit policy at the Sentry. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, you don't announce the funeral of the person who dies in the market. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.